You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
One of the main themes and messages of this podcast has always been that success can mean different things to different people. And how someone gets there, if they get there, seems to take a different path each time. Today's episode is with someone that I had the privilege of working with in the musical adaptation of First Wives Club back in 2015 in Chicago. We were gearing up for a hopeful Broadway transfer that unfortunately never happened. But Carmen Cusack gave a memorable performance in that show and went on to star in her Broadway debut of Bright Star and most recently Flying Over Sunset. Her journey to Broadway has been a unique one, from Denver and Texas to London and Shanghai. And all the while, she just wanted to be in an intimate jazz lounge singing the standards of Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. But as you'll hear in her three stories, that bumpy road to success is as much a personal journey as it is a professional one.
When I started, I was already burnt, but I was not a fan of musical theater. It's something that I landed into because I wanted to sing and I also wanted to act. I didn't own a musical album until I had to audition for something.
Welcome and thank you for joining me for another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, a Top 25 Theater Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer, talking with fellow creatives each week as they bring us three stories from their own life of personal struggles and professional hardships, with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can sign up for the Win Me newsletter and offer generous support of this podcast. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Well, Carmen, it is a joy to be with you, to be in your home.
Yes, welcome to the chaos.
I know. You were telling me you've only been here about a year, but you're still kind of working, trying to make it a home.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say it's a little bit over a year. We closed December 14th, 2020, which, God, I have no idea how that actually happened during COVID, but it did. And it was a long, crazy, crazy process of trying to buy a home during the pandemic.
Oh my gosh.
What a stupid idea. But we gave up at one point, and then this came back on the listings and I was like, let's go look at it, and we're just going to do asking price, and we're not going to get into a bidding war because we've been through bought that t-shirt and I don't want to, I bought sweets from that shop, not doing that again. Because we're actors and we're unstable, and this was a pandemic, and nobody knew what the hell was happening. So, it just seemed crazy at the time. And I just said, we're going to go in the listing price. If they take it, then okay. So we closed 14th of December and moved in the 23rd of December of 2020. Then I've been away half the time because luckily things started, you know, happening again. And my husband went back to work, but he works at Burbank Studios. He's got a bit of a more stable, I should say, touch wood when I say stable, because anything can happen. But so I get to just at the moment do these gigs that don't, you know, just be creative and do gigs that I enjoy and not necessarily the ones that that pay all that big money.
Well, I think that's what's interesting, because you've been on Broadway, you've performed in New York, yet you live in LA. And I think most people just assume, well, if you're on Broadway, you obviously live, you breathe New York, but yet you are not a New Yorker. And so how do you balance that kind of travel? And do you just go to New York only for certain projects? Or are you kind of open to traveling whenever, wherever?
I go wherever the work is that I feel at home at. You know, you're it's where I lay my hat. My home is where I lay my hat. And but as long as my husband can be with me for 70-80% of the time, then I'm happy.
So he travels with you as much as possible.
We kind of travel with each other as much as we possibly can. And luckily, he's an actor. So, you know, he works three weeks out of the month. And so it's worked out for us. We've been very lucky in being able to stay, you know, to stay connected, you know, even though we sometimes have to be apart.
Well, I think that's the thing with any actor, balancing the personal life, the relationships with the career. And it's going to be a different path. It's going to be a different puzzle piece to put together for every actor.
And every gig.
Yeah. Too. And each gig, because depending on if it's in Carolina or if it's back in your hometown of Denver or it's in New York or London, you know, it's all going to be a different path to get there.
Yeah. And luckily, both of us enjoy traveling and enjoy experiencing different, you know, atmospheres and climates. And so we enjoy it for the most part until we don't. And then we want to come home. And luckily, you know, finally we have a home to come to, which is nice.
That idea of enjoying it, sometimes not enjoying it, actually leads us into the first story that you wanted to share. And this was a time when you were in London. You had done the West End, you had done the big shows, Phantom, Les Mis, you were on top of the world when it comes to, like, you know, musical theater. And yet you were burned out. You were ready to be done with it, and you just wanted to be a jazz singer.
Yes.
You left theater. Well, what was it that burned you out?
I guess when I started, I was already burnt, but I was not a fan of musical theater. It's something that I landed into because I wanted to sing and I also wanted to act. And it seemed like...
I mean, that is musical theater.
I guess it is.
Why don't you
like
it?
But I knew I could do both. So I was like, you know, I felt like I was going to bite off more than I could possibly chew to just say, I'll just be a, you know, go into the movies or get a TV show, or just be a recording artist. It seemed like dipping the toe in and trying myself, you know, challenge myself in both areas. It seemed like the easiest gig to get at the time. And, you know, I was young and I could, they were gettable, were the roles in musical theater, even though I can't say that I didn't own a musical album until I had to audition for something and I had to go and buy the album so that I could learn all the music from it. And some of it, I was like, oh God, fast forward. Don't like that. Oh, now I have to sing this song. Okay. I guess I can deal. I think I can do it 8 times a week. And then you just continue to do things that you don't actually love, like singing the same songs that you would never listen to. You know, if you were sat at home or cleaning the house or doing whatever. And yet I was finding myself doing it 8 times a week and thinking, what am I doing?
So is this a version? Did you find that in Phantom and Les Mis? I mean, these are like the pinnacles,
sure,
of a lot of people's like bucket lists.
I know. Sorry. Some of the songs I could just about stomach 8 times a week, but others were just like, I put my ear heads on and just, you know, backstage and, oh God, this again. Just, you know, turn down the tannoy. Hope I didn't miss my entrance or my cue. Luckily, you know, I wasn't fired for anything, and I managed to make all my cues, even though half the time I couldn't listen to it all 8 times a week. And then I just thought, why am I doing this to myself? I really want to sing jazz, but there's no money in jazz. But I just thought, you know, there's not in England, there's no money in theater anyway, so why not?
But even in these big shows, I mean, were you still not making quote-unquote good money?
No, it was shocking to me. At one point, it really dawned on me the truth, because they do hide the truth from you when you're there and surrounded by other actors that are just making the same amount of money, and you just kind of make it work, and you're always, you know, in debt, and it's just, that's what you do. Everybody's just always in debt, and I guess that's the life that we've decided to live. And then one time I got asked to go merge with the American company of Les Mis. Cameron McIntosh wanted to do this experiment where he took some parts of the West End, merged it with an American cast, and then took a West End show to Shanghai. and see how we developed within that culture and how they developed with this, you know, this Western show. And BBC documented it, and it was just a really cool thing to do it. So I remember one time going out with the American cast and having a beer, and one of the guys just cheekily enough asked me, "So what are you making on this?" And I was playing Fantine along with Combe Wilkinson, and he was one of the ensemble guys. And I thought, well, I'm doing all right, because I was in the middle of a contract as Fantine in Les Mis in the West End when Cameron McIntosh found, you know, at the last minute, he needed someone that could work in America. He didn't have to go through the green card process because the girl that was actually supposed to do it burst her appendix at the last minute. So he needed somebody that knew the role and that could step and work in America immediately. And so we got to renegotiate the sums. And I was quite happy with what I was getting. So I was like, yeah, I think actors should talk about this. So this is what I'm getting. And he'd taken a swig of beer and then it literally like spewed out of him and I was like, yeah, I know, it's a lot, isn't it? And he said, that's our base sum. That's what we were getting 3 years ago for an ensemble. And I was playing the lead, you know, one of the lead roles. And that's when it really dawned on me.
So then did it turn out he was making more than you?
Oh, yeah, he was making more. He was making probably three times more. And that's when it really dawned on me that I need to get my butt back to America and make some money at this.
So was all this kind of what led into you being burned out of musical theater and just wanting
just
to get into jazz?
They were taking the piss. They were taking the piss out of us, you know? And, you know, we were paupers, literally, you know, like in old England times, just felt like I was a pauper, working my butt off and still not being able to pay my bills. And I was tired of that.
But as you said, there's not much money in jazz, so why did you think it was going to be better?
At least I would enjoy doing the music.
Oh, okay. All right.
At least all the songs I was going to sing, and I wasn't having to do it eight times a week. I was going to have more fun doing it. I love working with other actors, and I love the liveness of it all. You know, there was so many factors which kept me involved and kept me doing it eight times a week. But then I just thought, I just want a break. I just want to see what else is out there. So that's what I did.
Now, what's interesting about jazz music is that most of it comes from musical theater. So you're still having
there
to do musical theater as jazz standards.
But that's what's so funny. But the great thing about jazz is you get to have fun with it because you get to play around with the melodies and you get to do your own acrobats and still tell a story, but not necessarily with lyrics. Tell a story through the choices of the notes that you decide to hit. In the riffing that you decide to do, that's a story in itself, and I love the freedom of that.
Now, are there jazz singers that you get inspired from, or that you either emulate or wanted to be like that motivate you as a singer?
Well, I was inspired by all the greats, you know, Sarah Vaughan, Billie Holiday, and even Eva Cassidy. I don't know if anybody knows. You're familiar with Eva Cassidy. As soon as I heard her voice, I was like, well, that's something that I feel like that's the way I would phrase that. Before I even heard her, I would have done it that way. The way she approached the phrases were very much similar to what I would do. And then, you know, then I found out she had died very young and tragic. But I just loved listening to her. Like saxophonists and musicians inspired me in the jazz realm, rather not just singers.
Well, that's certainly one thing that I learned whenever I was first getting into jazz music and that kind of freedom, as you say, is that jazz singers oftentimes will approach the song as an instrumentalist.
Like, absolutely.
How would the trumpet approach this versus the trombone versus a saxophone? And use our voices in the same way that those instrumentalists
would use
theirs.
Exactly, because each instrument is telling you a different story. Well, for me, it is. It's like colors. When I hear music, sometimes I feel colors and I see colors and it's just all those beautiful connections just really inspire me. And that's why I was like, I don't care if I make nothing at this. I just need a break and I want to do this right now.
So then as you're this jazz singer now, you've put aside musical theater. Did you feel like, okay, now I'm where I should be. This is what I should be doing.
It was funny how it all came about because it was when I decided this was the day I was going to start singing jazz. It was literally New Year's Eve. And I was hanging out with some mates at the pub and we all kind of went around the circle, you know, what's your New Year's resolutions? And when it came to me, I was like, I want to sing jazz and I want to sing at Ronnie Scott's and I want to sing at Pizza Express and just hit all those, you know, those cool venues in London that I wanted to sing at. Because I had started gigging, I would do Les Mis and then I'd run over on every Thursday night to do this gig called the Kitsch Lounge Riot. And I would do like Dusty Springfield and just all this kind of cool 60s stuff and Dionne Warwick. And it was this really cool band. And I just loved hanging out with the band and musicians and communicating music live in the moment and creating something together in the liveness of it all. That's what got me interested in thinking, I can do this. I want to do gigs. I just want to do gigs. And the phone rang about 10 minutes later after I had said that. And it was a guy called Leo Green. He was a saxophonist that was getting a band together. And he was a son of a famous journalist slash DJ. And it was New Year's Eve. And so he had this big gig to do. And the singer didn't show up. And he said, but I got your number off of another mate. What's your list of songs? I was like, well, you know, basically all the jazz standards and then some. And he said, well, work it out. Can you get here and at so and such time? And I was, you know, hanging out with my mates at the pub. And I was like, in half an hour? Okay. So I thought, guys, I think this might be, I gotta do this, you know? And after that gig, it went really well. And he said, he just basically hired me on the spot. And they had a tour, you know, of just all the venues that I wanted to play.
That's wild. So you were finally in your own mind, in your own heart, you were now home as far as the kind of singer.
Musically, yeah. I was like, I was happy. I was so happy. But then you realize, oh, but I need to pay my bills too.
So it still comes back to money, but at least your soul was being fed.
Yeah, it was.
A lot better.
I enjoyed it.
So did you see this break from musical theater as something more permanent or really just something temporary? Let me get this out of my system and I'll come back to it.
I don't make permanent. Nothing's really permanent for me. I just have to go with where I'm at in this moment. I'm feeling dead. It's not giving me joy anymore. So I got to find something else. So I never stay too long in something if it's not giving me joy. So I never said, oh, well, this is going to be it. Because there were things about theater always that will give me joy. Then when I've given it a break, I'll come back to it. And I'll come back with it with fresh eyes and a fresh feeling and a fresh body and just ready to take that again.
As you said that, that correlated to me with our own personal lives and relationships as well, that we tend to go where the joy is. And there's this stereotype of actors and performers being, you know, bouncing around for this relationship, that one. Have you found a bit more stability in your personal life, but still maintain that freedom in your artistic life?
Well, when I decided I was going to do some jazz, I think I was single at that point. I was enjoying my singledom and just, you know, taking things, the opportunities that came along. I was never one of these gals that just would hop into bed with anybody. And you'd have to really gain my trust, and that would take time, a lot of time. So I just kind of dated a little bit here and there, but didn't really have a full-on relationship until my second husband, my present husband that I'm with now. And we're just looking at it. We've been together now 19 years, which is crazy. But yeah, at the time when I started doing the jazz, I just started dating him, I think. So he was there, he was supportive. But I will say, I think it does help to have some stability in some part of your life so that you can just kind of bounce about and play with other parts of your life. Well, that was for me.
Well, yeah, I do think that there's a correlation where we need to have that personal stability so that our artistic being can then be free to go in any direction.
Yeah, and he has been a rock. My husband has been my stable rock, whether it's emotionally or financially. You know, we both had our ups and downs with the finances, but we've been each other's rocks throughout all that, which is very, I feel very, very lucky, very blessed.
Well, that leads us into the second story that you wanted to share. And this one had to do with the musical Sunday in the Park with George. You've had a very tumultuous relationship with this musical.
Yeah.
And it began with you auditioning for it and not getting it. And so you were like, never again.
Well, that's actually, you're nearly right there. I never got seen for it. I couldn't get in the door to be seen.
Oh, you never even auditioned.
I never got to audition for it. So that just put a bee in my bonnet about the whole project. So I never looked at the show. I never saw the show, never showed any interest in except for the odd songs that I thought were really fun and beautiful, like Move On, that I would do in concert work. You know, there were songs from it that I had to learn for concert cabaret stuff that I was doing in London. But overall, I never saw the show, didn't really know what it was about. Until I actually get an audition for it when I had finally come back to America for Chicago Shakespeare.
So what exactly led you to audition for it again, even though you'd kind of written it off?
Well, because that time had passed and I was okay about it at this point. And I, after doing so many, learning so many Sondheim songs and realizing he's a writer for actors. He is a lyricist, composer for actors. And I have to do one of his shows at some point in my life. And then I circled back to, you know, I got this opportunity and was like, well, okay, I'm destined to play this role. And so it did happen. But then of course I didn't know anything about the show and showed up the first day of rehearsal, not off book like everyone else in the room was, which I thought was rude.
How dare they?
How dare they
be prepared?
Jerks. So yeah, it really kind of put me on the back foot, and the director was like, who is this person that's playing Dot Marie? And so there was a lot of skepticism, and I'm not used to having skepticism with my director, and because I'm my own skeptic. I'm already the person that says you can't do this.
You must have just felt like behind the eight ball from the get-go.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure. We're at one point I was wearing a t-shirt one day, and I was singing Trickle of Sweat, the back of the head. You know, always done this. Another book. Well, and luckily I was wearing a bra at the time. So, but he decided I was not hitting some moment for him. So he got a spray bottle and decided to start spraying me while I was singing the freaking song. And at the time I thought, okay, maybe I was open to it. Okay, hit me, hit me again. I enjoyed the spontaneity of that and thinking, oh, okay, maybe this, and I'll grab something from this and that'll be what he needs. I was open to it. But then, of course, apparently the rest of the cast were just mortified that he'd done this, and they were all asked to leave and go do some music work. Then later on that day, we came back to it, and one of the girls was like, I can't believe he did that to you. I can't believe. And she was telling all the cast, and I was like, oh, should I have been angry about that? Maybe I should have. Oh, okay. I just felt, you know, mad at myself that I wasn't bringing what I needed to bring, and that he had to go to that extent. But they were angry on my behalf. And
so once she brought it up, did it then make you start to be angry at that? Or
yeah, then I realized then I thought, well, yeah, that was pretty awful that he did that. I guess it was pretty awful that he did that.
I mean, because we spray cats when they misbehave, you know?
So. But I see, I'm just so, whatever gets the job done. And yet they were kind of right. I mean, that was kind of not cool to do that to me. And then I was like, gosh, yeah, that was really awful. But it still made me think, but how awful he had to do that. He felt the need to do that because I clearly wasn't doing something for him. I don't know. Maybe deep down, we all want to be spanked and harassed to some degree.
Yeah, it's that some attention is better than no attention.
Right.
Yeah. But did you feel that this being behind, was it just, okay, well, I just didn't prepare, but I'm still good. I'm still ready for this role. Or did it make you doubt your own ability to do the role?
Well, I was doubting my voice at the time because I think my voice was going through a slight change. And I was doubting my artistry altogether, because probably a lot of it had to do with that. And I was blaming myself rather than him. I was like, oh God, you're just awful. Carmen, you fooled them until now. They're not fooled anymore. So what are you going to do now? And I was questioning my artistry, my voice, what the hell I was doing. And then all of a sudden, I realized, oh, wait, this story is about questioning our artistry. Duh. Poor
Life
George.
Life imitates,
you know?
Art. Yes.
I know. And then I just thought, oh, this is hilarious. I've been sitting here taking up smoking and crying at the end of every rehearsal. And maybe that's probably why my voice was giving me jip, because I decided to take up smoking because I just was a nervous wreck. And then I thought, no, you know how to do this. Trust yourself. Just because you came in not knowing every single word of every single lyric and all the book, you've been doing this for a while now, Carmen. Don't let these other jerks tell you otherwise. Trust your instincts and embrace the fact that you're questioning what you're doing as well. Because as an artist, that is only going to make you better sometimes. I mean, not always,
sometimes,
but
yeah.
It can really help you to adjust and try something from a different angle. You know, I've always questioned. I've never gone about something with 100% confidence. And I think that's what's helped me get the jobs, because for the most part, because if you go in already deciding what you're going to do, then you're not leaving yourself open for what the director wants to try and what the other actors in the room need. You're not allowing yourself to be open to the moment. And that can be very harmful to your craft.
Yeah, because I don't know if you found this to be true, but I know that the auditions that I went in and was so confident and like, this role is mine, I know it, and I just nailed it. Those are the ones, I rarely get those.
Isn't that interesting?
Right.
And everyone connects to vulnerability. And especially when you're trying to form something and mold something that's not 100% developed. Nothing is 100% developed. And to go into it saying, I'm making some choices and I'm bringing my own experiences and my own damage and my own pain to this. And everyone can connect to damage and pain. And I think that's where people get excited to see something, you know, in a moment, in a live scenario, when you go up on a line and you're like, it's those magic moments and no one can, it's indescribable, those moments. And all of a sudden everyone's like, oh.
Most enterprises use disparate systems to manage spend. The result? A reactive manual approach. CFOs and controllers, you deserve better. You deserve a unified spend platform from Brex. Brex makes it easy to proactively control spend with cards, spend management, travel, and bill pay in one place. You can create budgets with controls built in, track and adjust in real time to keep teams accountable, and automate compliance to close the books faster. Ready to control your spend with one unified platform? Visit Brex.com.
There it is. There's that real moment. And you have to try and capture that at all times. And that's vulnerability mixed with experience and craft, but not knowing, we're here for this moment, and who knows what the next moment's going to bring.
I think that goes back to what you were talking about in your first story about jazz and the freedom and the way that in the moment you go a different way with this note, or you maybe, you know, kind of paraphrase a certain lyric so that it means a little something different or means something more. It sounds like that process of the musical theater is what you really crave.
Sometimes it doesn't go in the great place, because if you're with, like in a jazz moment, a musician, you'll think, okay, I'm going to do this. And if this guy goes here, then it will be magic. It'll be like an orgasm. But then if he goes this way, oh no, it could be catastrophic. But either way, we tried something, and it's always worth it in the end when you get the orgasm. Sorry to turn this into sex, but
no. Well, I mean, you know, it's a very visceral part of our existence on the personal side.
Yeah, and, it's worth it to try.
But also, I think that is something that we strive for artistically. We want those explosive moments. We want those times when it's like everything is just in alignment.
It's not prepared. It comes together in its magic. It's just a magical moment.
So then doing Sunday, you know, you'd written it off for so long. You finally get to do it. Did it match whatever expectation you had of finally getting to do it?
When the light bulb hit, it was probably the third or fourth week into rehearsals, which is right, you know, right about when you're going to go on stage and start doing it in front of people. But when the light bulb hit, it was indescribable. It was like, oh, got it. Because when I realized how beautiful that show was and how intricate and crazy and chaotic, because, you know, the first act and then the second act is just totally different beings, is when I thought, oh, God, this is more sophisticated than my head. I'm not smart enough for this. The devil was creeping in. But then, I don't know, it was just like literally one day, it was like the sun came up and the music was playing in my head, and it was glorious. And I was like, ah, it was almost like I had woken up into another being, and it all just kind of slotted into place. And it was like, in one day, it just kind of everything aligned, and I understood, and it made sense. And I can't explain why that was. It just, everything made sense. And I started to understand that what I was actually doing was right, because I was questioning it all. And the fact that I was embracing my own reality was slotting into place with this role, with this job, with this, the story that we were all telling.
Those light bulb moments are an integral part of every actor's journey, whether they happen on stage or in the audition room. And in this week's bonus episode, Carmen talks about one particular audition for the 2008 revival of South Pacific at Lincoln Center. Now, in the audition room, she played the character of Nellie Forbush in a way that had big-time casting director Bernie Telsey shaking his head. Now, bonus episodes like these are only available to monthly supporters of Why I'll Never Make It. But I do want to take a moment and give a big thank you to Brianna Anderson, who recently donated through PayPal, and I couldn't be more grateful for her support. So if you'd like to help this podcast as well, then please consider either a one-time donation, or if you'd like access to the bonus episodes, then a monthly subscription by going to whyillnevermakeit.com, or just look for the link in the show notes.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We pick back up with our conversation about Sunday in the Park with George and its original book writer and director, James Lapine. Well, he wrote and directed a new musical that opened in December 2021 at Lincoln Center called Flying Over Sunset, with Carmen as the lead actress. And she explains what it was like to work with this luminary figure of American theater.
Well, I'd had a little taste of being in a room with him, because I had agreed to do, you remember the concert version of Sunday in the Park that they brought to New York with Jake Gyllenhaal and Ali Ashford? Gosh, I agreed to do the concert version with them. So I was in the room with James, and at some point pulled him aside and said, you know what? Because of you and Sunday in the Park with George, this show, I nearly quit the business. I nearly had a nervous breakdown and quit the business. And he said, oh my God, why would you do that? He said, we were pretty much high the entire time we wrote that. And I said, that's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought, because it's kind of crazy, but it's perfect. And he said, oh yeah, we were totally high the whole time.
I think that's the explanation of how it goes from act one to act two.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just the chaos of it all. And then all of a sudden it makes sense in this weird way. And I kept thinking, God, I wish I could just have a little joint and then watch this show and it would all fall into place so perfectly.
So then getting to be directed by him more formally for a full production in Flying Over Sunset, Now, he conceived that, wrote that, as well as directed it. So it was a very personal piece to him. And did I assume you got that in the way that he directed, in the way that he approached the piece with mm-hmm. you?
Well, I was lucky enough to get in on the workshop or two before we – well, it was we workshopped it there at the Lincoln Center. And so I wasn't sure of the piece to begin with. I was sure I wanted to work with James Lapine. And but at the time in 2019, I wasn't sure. You know, there were so many other conversations that the world was having. I wasn't sure if this conversation was one I needed to be a part of. But I wanted to work with James on something that was new and interesting and collaborative, because I just was, you know, Sunday in the Park was kind of a little bit life changing for me. And so I did the workshop and thought, this is great. Still not sure, but I want to be a part of this. We'll see if it comes back around. It came back around. My reps were like, don't know if this is the right time to do this because it's pilot season and yada yada. And we were just about to hit 2020. But I thought, there's something about it. I still need to be a part of this. I still want to see where this goes. So I did the second workshop, and then we started to put it on the stage for Lincoln Center, and 2020 March hit, the pandemic.
Right, stopped
everything.
And
the day we were supposed to open for our first preview was the day that Broadway closed. And the storyline of Flying Over Sunset is about these people in these places in their lives where they're questioning their lives, kind of like where I was in my career, questioning what the am I doing? Who am I? How can I go back to my pain and bring that back to life and merge it with this craft and make it authentic and not hurt myself in the process? You know, just – and that's what these people were doing. It's about this story of these people trying to – having to look at their past and deal with their pain and deciding to try LSD together and see how they communicate and how they connect with each other. And it's all about connection. And then I realized after the pandemic that we really more than ever needed to have that conversation. So I was just so raring to go and ready to come back to that project and James Lapine and with a new frame of mind and a clearer head as to what I really wanted to bring to the table on that show.
How much did the show change from that 2020 when it would have opened mm-hmm. to then when it opened in December of 21?
I think for all the actors, we'd have all been changed. We'd all had evolved, and we were all so ready to come back to a room and see each other's faces and be with each other and then understand how important that story was to tell. Just to be here in this room with you, Patrick, is that special. You know, instead of looking at you on a screen, there's something just so more interactive about that. And listening to the weed blower outside, you know, it's also interactive and connected in some crazy way.
Yeah, it's all about being very present. And it's interesting that you bring that up about the use of psychedelic drugs, LSD, in the show. And in a way, these characters were trying to be more present. They were trying to find something within themselves that maybe was lost or locked. Yeah, and they didn't know how to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that us as actors, we can sometimes feel that way. As you've even mentioned it yourself,
yes,
about feeling like I don't know how to approach this. What am I doing? And then a light bulb moment,
all of a sudden,
magical.
It unlocks, and you can't even put your finger on or define it, but it just something unlocks. But you just have to stay in it and trust it. Whether it's the project or yourself or the director or maybe a little bit of everything, but just trust that we're on this planet to do something, right? To do something with our lives. And I believe, I believe for a very long time that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. At least I feel confident in that. I might not feel with the project that I'm doing. I might not have all the answers, but that's where the special sauce is. Not having all the answers, but finding them together as you go along. And it might be the very last, the last performance that another thing unlocks. And you're like, ah, there it is. But that's also the special. That's also what's exciting about being able to do a show more than once, you know, to do eight times a week. You find something every time you go out there, if it's something that you're loving.
So with that in mind, I've certainly had those shows where I kind of just had to white knuckle it through. I just had to push.
What show was that?
Well, there was one, it was a new show as well called Treasure Island. And, you know, I had my difficulties in remembering this line or getting that musical cue. And, you know, it was a new show, so things were changing. And come opening weekend, I was still in a haze as far as, well, wait, when is that? How does that? So I just wasn't as prepared as an actor. But then also my emotional state was like, oh my gosh, can I do this? And the light bulb, unfortunately, didn't hit till a week into the run.
That can also be about the project, you know, because they need to understand what's not hitting, what the actors, that's why we help them to create things, because maybe there's, you know, it's a story issue, you know?
Yeah. For you, whenever you've had those moments when the light bulb hasn't come on yet, what do you do to keep going?
Well, when you're in a thing that's beginning to move in some kind of direction and it's a new thing, I think you just have to be open. What I have learned in these new processes is to trust that your own instincts and what you've learned, they've asked you to come and help them develop something. So you have to be open with them as to what's not working for you and can they help you get there? And there's a way of saying that and there's a way of asking for that without it seeming like you're criticizing. But at the same time, if they're smart enough, they're going to understand that that's actually, she's not getting there because there's something here that I need to look at. And so it's, I think you've just got to trust yourself that you're at, every question that you're asking them is helping them too.
Yeah, it's interesting as you say that, thinking back to my own troubles with that show. I took the responsibility 100% on myself. And yes, there were things that I could have done better or differently. Yes. But at the same time, as you bring that up, it's like, because the director did come to me and said, how can we help? And I didn't know what to say. And I think had I been more aware of what exactly was wrong, what exactly wasn't clicking, then I could have said, well, what if we did A or B and maybe try this? Yeah. Then it could have been that collaborative help.
It's not always our job to be the problem solver. I take it upon myself to try and do things without egg on my face. So I've got to make it work somehow for myself so that I don't come out looking like an idiot. But we can't always solve the problem. It's not always our job to solve the problems. That's, you know, in the writer's hands also and the director's hands to captain the writer. Like, it was such a wonderful collaborative experience to do Bright Star and watch a legend, Steve Martin, write things that you think, oh, everything's going to be genius. No, it's not. Yes, people see the finished product with him for the most part, but to be in a room seeing what he was throwing at the wall and what was sticking and what wasn't was such an eye-opener and such an experience for me to understand that none of us popped out of the womb a genius. No, we just have to try, and try again. And if you're smart enough, like he is, he is a genius because he's smart enough to know what he needs to change because he's listening to the people that he's giving this stuff to. And he would be there every single, he'd write a line knowing, not sure if it was the right thing. And so anytime I would say the new line, he would creep up from some, I swear he was probably the ninja at some point in his life too, because you never, all of a sudden, where's Steve Martin? And then he would be like literally nose to nose with you, like at your, you know, at your back, just listening to how I would say it. Or he would see a facial expression that I would pull that was like, how do I say that? But I wouldn't literally say, Steve, this doesn't, what? What did you write? But he would be there to see any little face, like, I think my face kind of tells it all into what I can understand and what I'm not understanding and how does that connect with this? And so he was always there. Even when you didn't know he was there, he was there to ask because he knows as well, we've got to make it work. And if we don't understand, then there's something we've got to figure out together. That's what makes him a genius. He's open to understanding that he needs a lot of other people around to say, oh, that's funny. Oh, no, that's not. You know, because he learned on the spot with an audience as a stand-up. It's a constant learning curve. But Edie Brickell as well was like churning out these amazing songs, these beautiful, heart-wrenching numbers, and then having to throw the baby away, like literally having to throw the baby off the train to make it work. And Walter Bobby was there to captain both of them into how we needed to get there. It was a fascinating experience to go through, and it took years.
Well, I mean, it certainly paid off for you with Bright Star. I mean, you got a bunch of nominations. You yourself got a lot of critical acclaim for that. But both Flying Over Sunset and Bright Star didn't exactly meet up with expectations as far as their run, as far as finances and audiences connecting with it, and both closed early. Whenever a show closes early like that, do you blame the show? Do you blame yourself? Do you think, well, the audiences just didn't get it? What went through your head?
I think a lot of things. Timing. We came on the same year that Hamilton did. And there was that. We were also in the Court Theater, which is kind of, it's a suite theater, but it's kind of off in the distance. It's not where the tourists, it's not a tourist attraction area. Yeah, it kind of is sitting in the back. I think that was a choice that went against the run. I also think, not everyone that comes to New York and wants to see a musical would necessarily think bluegrass. That was another thing that was outside of the box, but another reason why I wanted to do it. I wanted to sing that kind of music. It was more of what I grew up on, and it was in my special natural spot. And I wanted to work with Steve Martin and Edie Brickell and Walter, just the whole lineup of people. But yeah, there were some things going against us at that time. But mainly, I'd say, mainly the big one being Hamilton. I mean, the spotlight just kind of went da-dong, and everyone else kind of was hidden in the bushes.
Yeah. And with Flying Over Sunset, I think it's kind of the same thing. People don't come to see a Broadway show and think, oh, let's go see LSD. People on LSD.
Yeah.
I mean, because it was a very unique show for Broadway, but I assume it was a very unique show for you as a performer.
Very unique. And in that I grew up highly religious, Bible belting. I never did drugs ever in my life until I became an adult and then realized how awesome they were. No, don't do drugs, people. I will say this, my parents had me when they were teenagers, so they would play house at the end of the day, at the school day, down in the basement and look after me, and they would have parties. And one day my mom did catch me teething on a tablet of acid in the shag carpet. So there you go. That was my first introduction to LSD at 2 years old. So then it was totally fitting that I should at some point do a show about LSD.
Well, did your mother tell you what happened to you? Like, what did a 2-year-old Carmen do on acid?
Probably had a really good time. she took me to the emergency room, and the doctor said, well, she's too young to pump her stomach, so just keep an eye on her, and she'll just have a good time for maybe a few days. I don't know. Anyway, that's my excuse.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, and when you're 2, you can't really verbalize what you're, so who knows
who
what
knows?
You went through. That was just a very happy time in your childhood. Oh my goodness. That's crazy. But yeah, because Broadway, Flying Over Sunset, as we said, that was just your second Broadway show. And is Broadway the pinnacle for you? In this kind of back and forth love hate with musical theater, where did Broadway fit into all that?
Honestly, I know it is a bucket list for people that enjoy musical theater or theater of any sort. It's a bucket list. I want to be on Broadway. But it was never, I just wanted to do things that made me happy, that I enjoyed, that inspired me. And I learned pretty quickly from other artists that would show up and talking with other artists, that not every gig was going to be inspiring. And sometimes I always knew that that wasn't necessarily the pinnacle of my life. I would just wanted to do stuff that, I just wanted the gig. I just wanted to enjoy the gig. And if that meant doing Kitsch Lounge Riot in Café de Paris at 11 o'clock till 3 in the morning with really awesome musicians, then that was living. I was living the life, you know, and that Broadway would come when it came, but I wasn't going to push it. I wasn't going to just say, oh, I'm just going to work as a waitress and save up to go to New York. I was just going to take life where it would take me. And life took me to the UK for 14 years. And the West End picked me up and I went on that ride and that was fun. And I don't know. And I guess in the back of my head, I just thought Broadway will happen if it does. And if it doesn't, maybe that means I've got this great recording contract and I'll be touring with the band. Or, you know, maybe I'll get that really cool, fun acting job on a TV or a movie set. I just kind of kept it open for whatever. And maybe that's my lack of ambition. I don't know.
Well, or much like being a jazz singer, you were just open to the freedom of where this note was going to take you, where that
right.
lyric was
yeah.
going to go.
Like riding the wave.
We all rode a wave of the pandemic. And I think for many artists, it was, you know, it certainly stopped what we wanted to be doing. But also it was a chance for us to stop, think, realize things about ourselves as people, as artists. And our third story, you wanted to share the realization that you came to when it came to the pandemic, and you had been writing your own music for a while, but the pandemic made you realize that, no, this, I'm really good at this. I'm a legit writer. This is what I can do. So it made you think of yourself or take yourself more seriously in that respect. What was it that caused that light bulb moment?
I don't mean to sound, I'm not trying to make the pandemic trivial, but with the pandemic came so much death and so much tragedy and loss of work and just so much loss. But, you know, with every glass half empty, you have to see the glass half full at some point. Otherwise, what's the point at all? And so with that in mind, I started to realize what a gift it was to have a moment to not have the constant pressure of being employed, not have the constant pressure of having to create, having to make something all the time, having a moment to just sit back and be quiet and really think about what we're doing, why we're here, and what does that bird outside, what is that bird telling me? It was so nice to have the quiet and so nice to hear my own inner thoughts. You know, you don't need drugs, you don't need LSD to really hear that inner voice. Sometimes you just need the quiet. And that's, I think, what the pandemic gave a lot of us, if we allowed that.
Yeah, because I know for myself, that's something that I've had to struggle with, because I tend to want to escape that voice, because it can be a negative voice. It can be something that reminds me of that downtime and why didn't you do that and what happened there and all the what ifs in my life. Does your voice go there, or does it tend to, as you said, open you up to more realizations?
It goes there. Yeah, the inner voice goes back to pains in my life, my upbringing, my you know, choices that people around me made, and then therefore the choices that I made, and all of it I'm thankful for because I'm happy, you know. The things that were inspiring me were the darkness inspired me to write, to sing about the light and the dark. And I think that's a perfect balance. And the pandemic brought me back to the darkness of what it is like to be isolated, what it is like to not be able to contact your friends or to have the fear of holding someone or hugging someone. Being in a room with another person, I never thought I would miss that as much as I did, because I do enjoy I spent a lot of time by myself as a young kid until my mom remarried, and then my life kind of exploded in that way. But I spent a lot of time by myself, and I enjoy that time. I've never felt uncomfortable by myself, because my mind, you know, there's always music in my head constantly. It's finding the lyrics to go with the music that is my challenge. But this pandemic just opened up space to express myself in a different way. And I can't really explain that, but just having the quiet and knowing that not everything has to be filled with another word. You need the space. And writing songs is about, not just about a bunch of lyrics, it's about a feeling, it's about a vibe, it's about a mood or a color.
Again, you're not bound to what's just on the page, because now you're creating the page.
Yeah.
And you're able to take a story or go in a particular direction or theme or subject, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really up to you as far as where the piece goes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Are there topics then? Are there things about you that are difficult to write, or maybe I don't want to go there?
Oh, no. You can go anywhere. I'm okay to go anywhere now, because it's all part of the life experience. And therefore, if you can put it, you know, some artists are able to, you know, throw it on a canvas, all of it. And whether you see it or not is up to you. So that's how I'm approaching the songs, my own writing, my own ability to write stories. I can know what I'm singing about. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the full picture of what I'm, you know, and that's the abstract of it all. And that's what I'm trying to encapsulate now, that I'm still going to throw it all out there. It's whether you see it or hear it or not.
Yeah, I think what you say is so true. I know back in my high school, college days, I got into poetry. I wasn't a songwriter, but I could do like basically the lyrics, the poetry. And I was dealing, a lot of it was helping me deal with my own sexualities as I was kind of figuring that out at the time. And even though it was my own writing, I wasn't going to share it with anyone. I was still a bit abstract about it. I was still like, instead of just talking about, well, I'm trying to decide, I'm sexual, what do I want to, I would talk about the fork in the road and which path do I choose?
Right.
And, you know, this path looks like this, and I would describe that path. This path looks like that, and describe the trees or the ground in a very abstract way. But in my own mind, I knew what each of those paths meant. And with writing, that's what we can do. We can tell a story that the audience is going to be like, oh, that's interesting. Whereas you're like going through crap, trying to get that story out.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do, is going from the abstract now. Because, you know, you go through these elevations of your own craft of being literal. And then, okay, how do I go about it, you know, not being so literal and going about it more abstractly. And so that's the excitement about writing, is having all, you know, trying to come at it from all these different angles and still being able to express everything. And I've just gotten so excited. It's enlightened me again with the whole pandemic and being quiet and always being the vehicle for someone else's story, and also being able to tell your story through their story. That's what I've enjoyed through the process of being, you know, their vehicle. But now I realize I'm not scared to tell my own story. I don't need to protect anybody else anymore. That's where I'm at this point in my life.
I think that's something that it's taken me a while to learn as well, in that I've played characters, you know, ranging from the villain to the leading man to the love interest, you know, all these different, and I've put on that character. And it's taken me a while to realize how much of me needs to be in those characters too. Because for the longest time, it was just a chance for me to not be myself, for me to be this other person and be this other life that I wasn't living. But it's only once I started. And I remember this happened in college once. We were doing a play called To Jillian on her 37th birthday. I don't know if you've heard of the play.
Wow, that's a title.
Right? And it's about Jillian, who died, and it's her 37th birthday. And so it's chronicling the husband's journey through that death and coming to terms with it. And I played the role, you know. But then there was the one night, and it was interesting. One of my professors was there, and it comes down to the pivotal moment where he finally comes to terms with it. He finally is not pretending anymore. He's not just, you know, putting on a good face. And because in college, you know, you just do the 1 week run. So like, I think it's like Monday through Sunday or something like that. And it was the Thursday night performance. And it was the first time I'd ever actually cried on stage. It wasn't me I was like in it, and I could barely get the words out.
Isn't that just a special?
Yeah. I mean, even now, like that was 20 some odd years ago. And I still remember that night. I remember that feeling. I remember, oh, and I just was like in it. And so I think it is important that that we recognize how much this art form, as wonderful it is to be Elphaba, to be this green thing that sings beautiful songs, there's still a bit of us that has to come out.
That's probably the biggest thing I've learned through this whole career process and hope to continue to embrace is myself and my own pain. Like, I don't need to put it to the side anymore and pretend to be somebody else. I have to become the better artist, to elevate anyone else's work. I have to be unafraid to embrace my stories.
It's a great place to be. And I think it's something that we all strive for. Because would you say that that has become your definition of success, really making it?
My definition of success, making it, is the freedom. Oh, God. Living in the moment. Yeah, absolutely. Embracing your own truth.
Whether or not anyone else sees it as true. Whether or not anyone else likes it, takes to it.
Yeah, and not caring.
Yeah, yeah. I think that it's a vulnerable place to be, but it's one of the more powerful stances we can take in our life to recognize that I'm enough for who I am and what I bring to this life.
Own it. Own your own story.
This has been such a joy to talk to you and hear your stories. Oh, thank you so much for sharing and opening up with us.
It's been fun. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you so much for joining Carmen and me today. But remember, the conversation continues not only with that audition story bonus episode, but also with the final five questions on the Win Me blog. You'll find a link to that in the show notes or by going to whyillnevermakeit.com. This week's listener feedback comes from Sharla, who reached out to me on Instagram and said, "Just wanted to pop in and tell you how much I enjoy your podcast. I don't have any clue about the inside of the acting world, but I do enjoy a good interview and you are great at it." Well, thank you very much, Sharla. I really appreciate you listening and enjoying this behind-the-scenes look at the theater world, and I hope you're learning something in the process. You, too, can follow this podcast on Twitter and Instagram at WinMePodcast. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music is by John Bartman and Blue Dot Sessions. Why I'll Never Make It is a Win Me Media production, and it is a part of the Helium Radio Network and a member of the Broadway Makers Alliance. Join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.